Okay, well, good afternoon. This is Richard Clem. I'm coming to you today from St. Paul, Minnesota, live on June 23rd, 2018, as part of a conference call CLE program on the subject of school safety. And also, you might possibly be listening to a recording for a podcast program. But in either case, during the course of the program, I will be giving a series of code numbers, kind of a letter followed by a three-digit number. Just write those numbers down when you hear them. At the conclusion of the program, email them to me, and I will use that information to record your attendance and get you a certificate of attendance issued. I believe I have five code numbers, so if you get all five, you get full credit, or if you're not able to stay right until the end, you can get partial credit. That should be sent to clem.law@usa.net. If you have questions about the program, either technical difficulties or substantive questions, feel free to email them to me at any time. Okay, I just checked my email, and that was something unrelated to this call. So if you do have substantive questions, email them to me, and I'll either get back to you after you listen to the recorded program, or I'll try to address them during or at the end of the program. Well, again, the topic of today's program is school safety. Obviously, it's a topic that's unfortunately been in the news all too much recently, with school shootings in Florida and then in Texas, the most recent ones we've had here in 2018. And if you're listening to a recording of this, I have the sad feeling that there might be other incidents that are timely and in the news that relate to the same topic. So I think it's definitely a timely topic now. Something for us to think about, not just as attorneys, but I think we should also keep in mind that we are to a large extent leaders in our community. People turn to for sound advice, and I think we should think of the topic in those terms as well. However, since we're attorneys, we'll start out by looking at what are the legal duties of a school district, and of course those always come up in the context of cases of somebody suing the school district after the fact, because that's where jurisprudence comes from, of course. However, it would be best if we could use those same principles simply to avoid the problem in the first place and not have any litigation. So, like I say, even though we as attorneys think of things from a litigation perspective, we should probably also take off our attorney hats and put on our community leader hats and think in terms of what we can do to prevent that kind of litigation in the first place. And certainly, if you're an attorney or potentially an attorney for a school district or something like that, well, then obviously those legal duties are very important for you to consider before the fact. I'll tell you a little bit about what my expertise on the subject is. I don't have any particular expertise other than hopefully trying to be a leader in the community and an attorney, so I guess I'm competent to talk about the legal aspects of it. But my other claim to fame, just a little bit of my background. Well, I was a kid once. I went to school, so I guess that makes me an expert on how schools should be run. I practice law, and I do these CLE programs, and I've discovered that continuing legal education is kind of a seasonal business. This next week, because there's a Minnesota deadline coming up, will be kind of a busy week for me, and the end of August is another busy deadline for me, because that's the real Minnesota deadline. Those of you in Minnesota will discover on June 29th that, oh, I can't finish in time. Well, don't worry. You actually have two more months to actually get things finished, because there's an automatic extension in effect. So I have that other busy season at the end of August. And then, of course, for most states, including Iowa, I have a busy season when December 31st approaches. So I'm always a very busy person on December 31st, dispensing those last minute CLE credits to attorneys who need it. But other parts of the year sometimes don't have a whole lot to do. So I was looking around for sources of additional income. And one of them that I seized upon because my kids came home from school and the teacher was sick today, but they didn't have a sub. So I signed up with our school district, and I am a substitute teacher in one of our local Twin Cities school districts. The first thing is I'll put in a little plug for that particular occupation, because if you like thinking on your feet, and you want to stay on your toes, it can be a very interesting job for an attorney to do. And most districts in Minnesota are very desperate for substitute teachers. In Minnesota, you can do it as long as you have a four-year degree in anything, and most states are pretty similar. So even if you're in a state other than Minnesota, you might want to consider that, because you're providing a real service to the kids in your community, because there would be sometimes when they would really nothing can get done if there's not at least a sub there, because then they're very much just scrambling trying to figure out just how to keep the kids out of trouble. And of course, your main job as a sub is keeping the kids out of trouble. Occasionally some learning actually takes place. And you're not going to make your first million substitute teaching, but if you're an attorney and if your schedule is such that you're free one or two days a week, you might want to consider that, because it's a very flexible thing. But anyway, I've been doing that for a couple of years, it gives you, the other thing it does is it gives you a certain level of insight into how the schools work, how the education process works. It's been very beneficial for me that way, just kind of stay in the loop with my own kids' education, because you get to know the people, and you kind of become a member of the team as opposed to an outsider. So that's where some of my expertise comes from. Not that I have any advanced degrees in education or anything like that, but just from the fact that I'm around them quite a bit, and I see things, in a sense that other people who are there every day don't see. So I feel competent to offer my suggestions in how school safety can be dealt with. Well, putting my lawyer hat back on, and the course materials, if you want to follow along on the page where you signed up, there's both a PDF format and some PowerPoint slides, you'll just have to manually advance from one to the other. The two are identical, so I'll be one of the providers who will at each point say, now turning to the next slide. I'll have you manually turn to the next slide if you have it in front of you. But if you don't have it in front of you, don't worry, but you can look up some of this stuff. But what is the duty of care of a school district for its children? The Minnesota case that I have here seems to be current law, actually dates back to 1984, and that was a kind of a kinder, gentler time. When the only school violence you had to worry about was one kid beating up another kid or something like that, but in general the same standards apply, and the standard is written pretty much says it's a jury question, because the school's duty of care is to use ordinary care to protect its students from injury resulting from the conduct of other students or of third parties, under circumstances where such conduct would have reasonably been foreseen and could have been prevented by the use of ordinary care. So, in other words, it's really a jury question on the issue of whether or not there is negligence. But here the Minnesota Supreme Court provides a little bit of guidance to say, but on the other hand, there's no requirement of constant supervision. So you'll face a directed verdict if uh, if the only argument you can make is, well, if they had been watching this person every second, that's not the standard of care. But generally, it's a jury question. On the other hand, the court also goes on to say that merely because there's no prior notice of danger, this person snapped, and there was no prior evidence whatsoever that this person was going to snap, well, that does not automatically relieve them of liability. The teacher or administrator or school district is not required to anticipate the hundreds of unexpected student acts which occur daily, and I can vouch for that. Hundreds of unexpected student acts occur daily, and they're not required to guard against dangers inherent in rash student acts. But once again, if reasonable supervision could have prevented the accident, that's the standard of care in Minnesota. So in most cases, it's probably going to be a jury question. A related issue to that is shown in the next slide, where I quote an Iowa case, and I think the common law of most states is probably about the same. In any case, of course, involving criminal action by a third party, one of the issues is going to be, was that intervening criminal act a superseding cause? Generally, the answer to that question is going to be no. There's still proximate cause, even though another student's or a third party's misconduct or even a criminal act was the precipitating cause of the injury, because negligent supervision is essentially what the claim is, what you're supposed to be supervising against is exactly that, the wrongful or even criminal conduct of third parties. So if in that, under that general standard, if a reasonable person would have anticipated that danger and taken some steps to guard against it, then you as a school district are not going to get very far by saying, well, but the criminal act of this third party was a superseding cause. The test is whether, again, the reasonably prudent person of jury fame would foresee that injuries of this same general type would be likely to occur in the absence of adequate safeguards. And if you can show that those reasonable, adequate safeguards would have been effective, then the defense of superseding conduct by a third party is not going to get you too far. The glimmer of hope, though, for the attorney defending a school board against a case like this is shown in the next slide, the doctrine of discretionary immunity. Now, I would be lying if I said I fully understand what discretionary immunity is all about, because I don't understand fully what discretionary immunity is all about. But on the other hand, I don't think anybody fully understands exactly what discretionary immunity is, other than it's this defense that government entities will bring up as a defense to a negligence action because some actions of government agencies enjoy discretionary immunity. I say I don't understand it, but I'm not sure if the attorney on the other side fully understands it or if the judge understands it either. I think it's more applied in kind of an ad hoc basis, given the circumstances of the case. And if it just doesn't feel like there should be liability on behalf of the government entity in a case, the court's going to apply discretionary immunity. But discretionary immunity, I think what it's really intended to mean is that a government policymaker, such as a school board or a school administrator or even a teacher, is going to be called upon to make judgment calls, to make policies, to make decisions of, you know, what steps are we going to take to prevent this kind of danger or that kind of danger. And in cases where a government entity is exercising that kind of policy making, well, they have a broad amount of discretion in how they're going to make policy, because there are only so many tax dollars to go around to prevent every conceivable harm, and the decision of how to expend those resources has to be vested in someone, and we vest that in city councils and state legislatures and school boards and maybe managerial or supervisory employees. We give them that discretion to make those kinds of decisions, to allocate those resources. And the doctrine of discretionary immunity, as shown here in a Wisconsin and an Iowa, or a Wisconsin and a Minnesota case, kind of states that. Because in this case, it was a teacher criminally assaulting a student. Obviously not something that's supposed to happen. But this does not establish the school district adopted specific rules or policies that were negligently implemented. So in that case, I don't know what the ultimate ruling was, but they were saying that whether or not the district had enough policies in effect to prevent an employee or a third party or a student or anybody from engaging in some kind of criminal activity, that's the kind of subject where we give the school district a great deal of discretion in what policies they should implement. And then if somebody implements that policy negligently, well, then there very well could be liability. But the courts, under the doctrine of discretionary immunity, I think the takeaway of that doctrine is that courts should not second-guess the policy decisions made by decision-makers in the executive branch or legislative branch, because they have to figure out how to allocate limited resources, and they are the ones who have to come up with those policies. So if you're a litigator, if you're a defense attorney for a school district, you'll certainly want to delve a little bit more into the subject of discretionary immunity. But I think it's important for all of us, even the non-attorneys here, to recognize that there is something called discretionary immunity. Because a lot of times there's a tendency on the part of people who are scared off by us lawyers to say, well, we better not do something because if we do something, we'll get sued. And I think the doctrine of discretionary immunity should be brought up anytime somebody suggests that we should not take action to solve the problem because we might get sued. Because I think if it's applied correctly, the doctrine of discretionary immunity says, no, you can't be sued for making reasonable policy decisions. You're more likely to get sued if you worry too much about getting sued. So I think when we as community leaders are talking to our members of the school board, saying what can we do in this situation, and then somebody utters those words, well, you know, we can't do that because we're afraid of the liability. You don't have to be afraid about the liability if you make a reasonable policy decision, but maybe you do have to be afraid of the liability if you don't have any policies in place. So that kind of outlines the actual law that we're going to be talking about, and that reminds me that at 2:21 here, I'm going to give our first code number for the program. So if you're taking the program for CLE credit, please write down the following code number of S182, S182 is the first code number for today's program for CLE credit. Well, I am not an expert in any sense of the word on school safety. But the reason I wanted to give this program is because in the wake of these incidents, there's always a lot of discussion, often heated discussion, of people from both sides or all sides of the political spectrum with their idea of this could have been prevented if only we had done and fill in the blank. So if you're on the left side of the political spectrum, you'll say, we need more gun control. or if you're on the right-hand side of the political spectrum, you would say something like arm the teachers. And there's a tendency to say, if only we had done this one thing, if we had come up with the solution, if we had come up with this this one magic bullet, we could have stopped the problem. So I'm going to fight for this this magic step to be adopted, and really not listen to what anybody else has to say. Well, to my friends on both the left and on the right, and even in the middle, I say no, that's the wrong way of looking at it. You can't look at the one thing that we can do to end all school violence, because you will fail. Because if my left wing friends come up with the solution, well, then my right wing friends are pretty quickly going to be able to tell you why that won't work. And similarly, when my right wing friends come up with the solution, my left wing friends are going to be able to very easily come up with the solution of saying why that won't work. Because for every solution we can talk about, there are many reasons why they won't work. So therefore, I think it's important to look at the issue from a different perspective. No, we are not going to be able to come up with one thing to be able to solve the problem. What we need to come up with is a different mindset, a different way of looking at the problem. Because once we come up with that different mindset, I think we will realize that there are multiple solutions. And as a historical example of that, I'm going to turn to our next slide here, which is two newspaper headlines. And these are newspaper headlines that, that you don't see very often. Because the first one from 1915 I believe in Connecticut, it was a school fire in 1915. According to the headline, 27 children died. And I think the ultimate death toll in that might have actually gone up a little bit. It was a fire in a school out east somewhere anyway, many children died as a result of that fire. Not because it was a particularly severe fire, but what happened is in that building the doors opened inward. The exit doors to the building opened coming inside. So you have a group of panicked children racing for the front door, and there's no way to open the front door because you have a sea of humanity pushing against it. If you look at any public building today, you will never find any public building where the doors open inward. In every case, universally, in the United States and most countries, doors to public buildings open outward. And that was the lesson learned from that 1915 fire. That of those 27 deaths would have been prevented if only the doors had opened outward. That was the lesson learned. So the people at that time who came along and said, this is outrageous. We need to make one change to prevent school fires. We need to have doors that open outward. And of course, they were right. The fact that pretty much any door in any public building in the country opens outward can really be traced, I think, to that fire in 1915, because that one relatively easy step would have saved the lives of those 27 children. But there were still school fires. And the other headline here from Chicago, I believe it was December 1st, 60 years ago, 1958. There was a school fire at Our Lady of Angels in Chicago. And in that fire, 90 children died. It was one of the worst disasters, certainly one of the worst disasters of that year, one of the worst school disasters of all time. And in that fire, 90 children died. If it weren't so tragic, I would call that a comedy of errors, because it was those 90 children died because seemingly everything that could have possibly gone wrong did go wrong. There was a small fire that started in a boiler room, and the cause of that fire has never really been conclusively determined. But there was a small fire in the boiler room. There was some speculation that it was children playing with matches, or it was some speculation that it was underage smoking. Some kid went down there to sneak a cigarette and wound up causing this fire that killed 90 people. So again, the underlying cause of the fire was really not known. But what we do know is that these 90 deaths could have been prevented in many ways if not everything had gone wrong. Because what happened was this fire was smoldering down in the boiler room, and some kids were sent down to empty the waste paper basket. That was where the trash was gathered. So they went down there with the waste paper basket to empty it. They discovered a fire. They saw there was smoke down there. Something was burning. So they ran back to class and they told their teacher, and the teacher decided to investigate. So she talked to another teacher, and they went to look for the principal. So they asked the principal what to do. The principal was not in the office because the principal was off teaching another class somewhere. So they didn't get great guidance on what exactly to do. Some valuable minutes were wasted while they tried to figure out what to do, because this teacher apparently looked at it and said, a decision what to do in a fire, that's beyond my pay grade. That guidance for situations like that should come from somebody higher than me. So valuable time was wasted. There was no fire alarm sounded. The school was equipped with a fire alarm, and students were instructed that if they heard the fire alarm, they should drop everything and immediately evacuate the building. But the switch for that fire alarm, it was not like we have today where a bright red, box marked fire is in every hallway. It was just a standard light switch mounted in the principal's office, unmarked. And it was the principal's job to flip the switch. Well, once again, the principal was not there to flip the switch, so the fire alarm was actually never sounded. Eventually, some of the teachers decided, we have to evacuate the building. But by that time, the fire had spread for a couple of reasons. One is because there were a lot of combustible materials in the building constructions, like ceiling tiles and so forth. And also, there were two staircases in the building, one at each end of the building. But those staircases were not sealed off from the outside world. They opened directly into the floors. So by the time the decision was made to evacuate, there was still a safe stairwell at the other end of the building. But by that time, the building had filled up with deadly smoke from the stairwell closest to the fire. Other contributing factors was I don't know if the school had the telephone, but for some reason, eventually when one of the teachers gave word that we better call the fire department, they were sent to an adjoining building on the campus of the parish. So a kid runs into this parish office and saying the school's on fire. Well, the person in that building took some minutes to investigate to determine that there really was a fire before calling the fire department. So valuable time was wasted there. A motorist drove by and saw smoke and flames, and that motorist stopped at a store and went in and said, "I need to use your phone." And they were told, "We don't have a public telephone here." And he said, "But the school is on fire." So again, the proprietor of that store, rather than immediately running to the nearest phone, went to investigate to make sure that the fire department had to be called. So as a result, by the time the students were alerted to the fact that the school needed to be evacuated, it was too late. By the time the fire department arrived on the scene, which was about a half an hour after flames had actually been spotted, it was too late for them to do much. Just one engine company responded initially, quickly called for more backups, but they couldn't even fight the fire because what they had to do is just get ladders up to the windows and evacuate as many children as they could. So that fire in 1958 really was kind of a wake-up call to say we have to do multiple things to prevent deaths in school fires. There's not just one magic bullet that we can use to solve the problem. There are multiple things that we have to do. And turning to the next slide here with the word summary at the top, this is a report, a very scathing report, put out a month later by the National Fire Protection Association, saying that the 93 deaths, apparently gone up since that headline, the 93 deaths in this fire are an indictment of those in authority, both school authorities and city fire authorities, who have failed to recognize the life safety obligation of housing children in structures that are fire traps. And then it lists all the contributing causes. Schools that had lacked adequate exit facilities. There were no sprinklers of any kind. There was no automatic fire detector. There was not an automatic fire alarm. The fire alarm that did exist had a switch that only one person knew how to operate. It was not a case where just anybody becoming aware of the fire could immediately make the alarm. So there was an inadequate alarm. There were excessive amounts of highly combustible interior finish. The doors were thin and combustible. Ceiling tiles were combustible. Trim was combustible. Even though it was a substantial brick building, there was all this combustible material inside. Substandard fire alerting means, no direct contact with the fire department, and finally poor housekeeping conditions. School and fire authorities must take affirmative actions to rid their communities of such blights. To a large extent, that's what happened after that 1958 fire. People woke up and they said, and importantly what they said is we have to do all of these things, or at least we have to do most of these things. Because in all of these cases, if you look through the list of different things here, if you do one of these things, well, if they had done any one of these things in this particular building, it would have been okay. If the fire department had been called immediately, if the fire alarm had been sounded immediately, if the stairwell had been sealed up, any one of those things would have saved the life of these 93 people. But on the other hand, for future cases, you look at that, well, yes, we're going to provide, let's provide adequate exit facilities in our school. Our school has adequate exit facilities, so we're not going to worry about fire alarms. Nobody would say that. Similarly, nobody would say, well, our school has sprinklers, so we don't have to have fire drills. Or our school is just a block away from the fire department, so we don't have to worry about good housekeeping practices. Because, well, the housekeeping practices are the proverbial oily rags stored down there, apparently, which was one of the contributing causes. But in any sense, nobody would look at these and say, we're going to do this one thing, and this one thing will keep us safe. Like they did in 1915. They fixed one thing. They fixed the doors that opened inward. Fortunately, in 1959, they did not say, well, let's just do one thing, because that will prevent fires. No, what happened in 1958, 1959 is, in the wake of this tragedy, policymakers in the schools and fire departments looked at this and said, we need to have multiple redundant layers of security. So we have to do all of these things, or at least most of these things, because maybe adding new sprinklers to the building is cost prohibitive. But we have to do all of these things, or most of these things, because even if one fails, the chances of all of them failing get very small. So I think the takeaway from this is that for things like school shootings, we have to take the same approach. We have to think in terms of multiple layers of security. So if you're one of my left-wing friends and one of my right-wing friends comes up with a suggestion, don't dismiss it out of hand, because maybe they have come up with one of those redundant layers of security that will augment yours. And similarly to my right-wing friends, when my left-wing friends come up with an idea, don't dismiss it out of hand simply because it won't work all the time, because maybe it is one of those multiple redundant layers of security. Because the how have we done? How has the fire departments of the United States done in the wake of this 1959 fire or 58 fire? I will say they have done an extraordinarily good job. We have done an excellent job of protecting our children from fire. You do not see headlines like those anymore. Because in the last 50 years, and figures can be twisted a little bit, but in the last 50 years, do you know how many deaths there have been from school fires in the United States in the last 50 years? Well, the answer to that is zero. We have done a perfect job of protecting our children from fire. Not because we took any single perfect preventative step, but because we took all of these steps. So yes, there are still fires, but we take steps to prevent them with multiple layers of security, the kinds of things talked about in this National Fire Protection Association report. Interestingly, what's missing from this report, though, they talk about sprinklers and fire alarms and so forth. They really don't say a single word about the cause of the fire here. And I think in recognition of the fact is, well, there will be fires. They will be caused. The one thing they talk about that maybe we could call part of the cause is the poor housekeeping, because apparently there was old papers stored haphazardly in this area that caused the fire. But it doesn't say anything in here about, and one of the things we have to do is make sure children don't play with matches. Or we have to crack down on underage smoking, because that was one of the causes of the fire. No, they really don't talk about the cause of the fire. Kind of a recognition maybe of the fact that well, there will always be fires. And yes, we want to do what we can to fight the causes of those fires. But we also have to recognize that once there is a fire, if there ever is a fire, we need these multiple layers of security in place to prevent them. And what we need are policies to make that happen. Now, one legal citation that I did not include in the course materials, but I did add a link to it on the course description on the page where you signed up for the program. I included a link to a recently, it takes effect a week from tomorrow, Iowa statute. That the Iowa legislature weighed in, and I think with the proper way of dealing with the problem, Iowa passed a law saying that school districts for public schools and the boards of directors of any accredited private school in the state must have plans in place. They must have procedures in place to deal with these. I don't think it's helpful for a state legislature or a federal government to come in and say, here, local school district, here are the steps that you have to take to prevent school shootings and other disasters in your school. But on the other hand, I think it is appropriate to say you must plan for these things. You must sit down and come up with reasonable plans for dealing with potential causes of harm. And now this Iowa statute specifically lists the possibility of a school shooting as one of the things that that a school district has to do some affirmative planning for. So I think that's the right approach, and I think that kind of that multi-tiered approach is what you have to do. You have to have plans in place. You have to think about these beforehand. And in the remaining minutes, we'll talk about some of the things we have to do. In the meantime, I have to give my next code number. The next code number is S202. S202. S202 is the next code number for this program. And then we turn to the next slide, which where we see a picture of a 1960s era transistor radio. Well, why do I have that there? I have that there as a reminder that what we cannot do is simply teach to the test. Schools are frequently accused of teaching to the test because we want our kids to be smart. The powers that be in their infinite wisdom have come up with tests, saying that students have to take these tests to prove that that we as educators have made them smart. And if they pass the test, that proves that they're smart, and that proves that the school has done their job. In theory, that sounds like a good idea, I guess, but unfortunately, it often leads to teaching to the test. The concern is not really anymore whether or not the kids are smart, but the test is we just are worried about whether or not the kids are going to pass the test. I think that's to a certain extent an unfair criticism of educators, but unfortunately there've so many tests have been foisted upon them that it's kind of a natural result. We can't do that when it comes to preparing for emergencies, though. You have to prepare for emergencies. You can't prepare for the test. And here, I hearken back to my expertise of having been a kid once, having been a student in the elementary school in the late 60s and early 70s. And our school then took emergencies seriously. We didn't give the slightest amount of thought of anybody coming in and shooting anybody, but we took seriously. We had good fire drills. We knew what to do in case of a fire. And this was in the wake of the great Fridley tornado of 1965. And one key issue on everybody's mind was severe weather. You have to keep the kids safe because what if that tornado had struck when school was in session? So the school had good procedures in place. There was an alarm signal that all the kids knew, and if the tornado alarm went off, we knew exactly what to do. We went to the basement or to an interior hallway, and we took cover there. And I'm confident that we would have been protected in the case of severe weather. But you might want to go a little bit further. Because if you have if there's a tornado coming, well, the power is probably going to go out, you want to know if there's another tornado coming. You want a battery operated radio to monitor the situation. You want flashlights, and you want kind of that next level of protection once you've done the bare minimum of getting the kids down in the basement. One year we had a tornado drill, and this was a little bit more elaborate than most. I suspect the school emergency management officials were there, and I suspect the fire department was there watching over our shoulder and watching how well we had done. And we had our drill. We went down the basement, and then I saw one of my teachers. One of the teachers in the building walking around with a battery-operated radio, not unlike this one. And I have to tell you, I felt pretty good about that. The school here is taking good care of our safety. If there had been a real tornado and we're huddled down here in the basement and the power goes out, well, we can turn on the battery-operated radio. And here in Minnesota, WCCO will tell us when it's safe to come out. Or if you're in Iowa, WHO or whatever your station of record is, that will kind of tell you when it's safe to come out. So I felt good about that. We were going to be in touch with the rest of the world because here we are in a tornado. We have a battery-operated radio. So I felt pretty good about that until that afternoon. The teacher who was showing off the battery-operated radio, he lived in the neighborhood. He walked to work, So I saw him walking home at the end of the day, and sure enough, in his hand, there was his battery-operated radio. And I realized that that battery-operated radio would not do us one tiny bit of good in the case of an actual tornado, because really what they had been doing was teaching to the test. We got an A-plus on the tornado drill test because we got the extra points for having a battery-operated radio. So we did really well on the test, but that battery radio in reality meant nothing. The thing to remember is you can't teach to the test. And unfortunately, I do see a little bit of teaching to the test. In fact, quite recently, as a substitute teacher, we'll be jumping ahead to locking doors in a little bit, but obviously it's important for a teacher to have a key to the door and an ability to lock the door. More than once, usually when I report as a substitute teacher, the school gives me a key, and you know, shows me where my room is, and I have a key, and I can lock and unlock the door at will. But sometimes, for various reasons, that's not possible. Sometimes the secretary will come down and unlock the door for me, and let me in, and you know, then I'm on my own. Well, what I've taken to doing in that situation is I always tell them, you know, please leave the door locked. Lock me into the room. So that if in case of an emergency, I can quickly lock that door, because I do not want to be left in charge of these students. Because, you know, really, the reason I'm there is I'm there for one reason, and that is to keep them safe, because, you know, they're probably not going to learn anything with the day the substitute is there. But really, the one thing that they're paying me for is to keep them safe, and I can't do that with an unlocked door. So what I typically do in those situations is I tell them that, you know, please leave the door locked. And sometimes they seem a little bit confused about that or wonder why I asked that, and they say, well, in case of a lockdown. And more than once I have been told, oh, don't worry, there's not going to be a lockdown today. Well, my response to that is I don't care the slightest bit on whether or not there's a lockdown drill that day. If there's a lockdown drill and we fail the lockdown drill, the worst they can possibly do is fire me. And, you know, so that's not a huge concern for me of whether or not we do well on the test. I don't care how we do on the test. I don't care if we get an A-plus for a lockdown drill. What I do care about is if it's the real thing, is whether I have the tools, such as a locking door, that I need to protect the kids. So again, we have to be careful not to teach to the test, because that's just no good. Well, now here I was worried about I wouldn't be able to fill up an hour, and I guess it's probably right that we only have 10 minutes to talk about, well, what are the things that we can actually do to prevent these kinds of tragedies in the future. Because I think to me, the point is we should not be fixated on what is the one thing we can do. We just have to keep in mind that what are the multiple things that we can do to provide multiple levels of security, not every one of which will work every time, but what are these multiple levels of security we can do. The first one I just note here is, and these are in no particular order, so turning to the slide after the question marks, I have a slide entitled Armed Police Officers, because my right-wing friends will correctly point out to me that, and I think they are correct, when they say that if you have a bad guy with a gun, you want a good guy with a gun. So if we could arm the teachers, I don't want a gun when I'm doing my job. I don't want the kindergarten teacher down the hall with a gun. I don't think that person wants one either. But on the other hand, we do have in our society a job description of people who do have guns, namely police officers. So I think one step that, not the only step is, there probably should be an armed police officer in the school all the time, or most of the time, or at least very close to the school, because the lesson we learned from Columbine, that seems like a long time ago, the lesson we learned from Columbine is back then the thinking was If there's an armed person in a school, what you should do is the police officers arriving with their sidearms should wait outside and keep a perimeter and wait for the SWAT team to get there because the SWAT team has the proper tools. And of course, that's right. If I was in a school situation or in a hostage situation of some kind, I would want the SWAT team to be there. But on the other hand, I want that cop on the beat who only has a sidearm. I want him in there right away. So the thinking not perfectly played out, unfortunately. But the thinking is that the first officer on the scene, that is his or her job to rush in there, even though they are outgunned. Having a school resource officer armed in all or most schools, I think is just kind of a common sense idea. When I was in school back in the long, long time ago, starting in junior high, there was an armed police officer in the building all or most of the time. But can there be other officers here, though? Because maybe we don't have money to put a cop in every school. Well, we have cops on the beat, and they have to go somewhere to write their reports and so forth. Maybe the step of encouraging them to do that at our schools would be helpful. So have a break room for local police officers there, or a lot of times they sit in their squad cars and write their reports. They should be made aware that the school parking lot would be an excellent place to do that. In fire safety, one thing we think about a great deal is how close the school is to the fire station. The police, maybe it's not quite as relevant of a factor, but if you're an urban planner and you're deciding where to put the new school and or the new police station, maybe locating them in close proximity is a good idea. One issue to think about is, should off-duty officers be encouraged or required to be armed when they are off-duty? Because cops have kids in school too. They're taking their kids, dropping them off in the morning. Should they be encouraged to be armed? Should patrol officers, what weapons should they have in their car? Again, I'm not an expert on any of these subjects, but these are the kinds of questions we have to think about, not with the sense of what is the one solution we can come up with, but what are other solutions. Now, I put a question mark here because I know this is controversial. Well, what about other armed citizens? Should we arm the teachers? Well, probably not. I don't think the first grade teacher or the gym teacher, you want them running around the gym with their sidearm strapped on. On the other hand, we probably shouldn't say that no, never can we do that, because what if a retired police officer wants to do a second career as a teacher? In that case, maybe it would be appropriate. So I would not say to my right-wing friends that, yeah, that's a good idea, but on the other hand, I would not dismiss it out of hand. Many architectural features can go into mind, such as locking doors. And once again, you want doors that can lock, not because that will keep every intruder out, but because that will keep some intruders out. It will be one of our multiple levels of security. And at this time, I'm going to give our third code number, S376. S376 is our next code number. S376 is the next code number. The next possible, not the solution, but next level of security is a single point of entry to the building. Now, this is one where I've never heard of the Lieutenant Governor of Texas before, but here the Lieutenant Governor of Texas unfortunately got himself in the news by allegedly saying this was caused by having too many doors, not too many guns, it was too many doors. I feel sorry for the guy because he was kind of right, because one thing that the schools in our area are excellent about and almost obsessive about is that there's a single point of entry to the building. Will that prevent every every crime from taking place? Of course not. But there's one point where everybody coming into the building has to pass. And if that's a crazed gunman, at least it buys time for everybody downstream, because the office staff can at least call the police. I have a picture here of a metal detector. Is a metal detector a good thing to have in schools? Well, maybe in some schools it is. Maybe it is a solution of multiple solutions. On the other hand, I don't know if it's that good an idea, because you and I, as attorneys, we walk through these things all the time down at the courthouse, and it's not—it's kind of a pain, but not particularly burdensome, because you're there in court at 10 o'clock, so you have to get there at 9:45 to allow a little extra time to go through the metal detector. And that works pretty well in a courthouse. On the other hand, in a school, everybody arrives at the same time. So by putting a metal detector there, all you've done is created a large group of students outside the building as they work their way through that machine. So I don't know if that's the best idea, but a single point of entry, I think, is a good idea. Having procedures in place, looking at our next slide, though, I think is the main takeaway. You want to have procedures, but you also want to have discretion. So you do not want to be in a situation where we have a procedure in place, that the principal is the one to flip the fire alarm switch, because you have to have discretion in the hands of other employees. Of students, to say that this is an emergency situation and I'm going to take action, and I know what kind of action to take, even though I've not received the official word yet. You have to give discretion to people. There have to be drills. Looking at the next slide, and here the drill. This picture was taken in California, so it's an earthquake drill. We don't have to worry about earthquake drills in Iowa and Minnesota, but having drills, and the schools where I teach are actually pretty good about having these drills. The kids take them seriously. There is being an announcement, this is a lockdown drill, and we get everybody in the room with the door locked, and keep them in place. An important aspect is talking to students. You have to talk to the kids about this. I show a couple of posters here, one from the Department of Justice. The other one on the slide where it just says emergency procedures, this is the poster that's up in every classroom in the district where I teach. I've blocked out the names and identifying information. There are procedures here. In the case of an active shooter, it gives three pieces of advice in order of run. There's no shame in running away, because if you have a bad guy with a gun and everybody runs away and he's the only one left there, then you have won and he has lost. So step one is run away. Number two is hide. Again, no shame in hiding. But if those don't work, step three, the last resort, and yes, we tell our kids here that yes, fight, if you feel comfortable doing so. As a last resort, fight back, because as the Flight 93 passengers learned, as a last resort, it's really not going to do you any harm to fight back, and it might do some good. So we admit that to our students. Now, let me give the next code number here, because we're actually going to run over a little bit of time. Our fourth out of five code words is S. 461. S-461. S-461 is the next to last code number. Will we scare the kids by talking about this? And the answer is no, because they are already thinking about this. I was in one classroom where we had second graders, and we had a lockdown, and I pointed this poster out to them and talked through the situation, and it was very clear to me that I was not scaring any one of them. Because these kids had questions showing that they had given all these matters a great deal of thought, and they needed some reassurance from trusted adults saying that, yes, we're thinking about them too. Because I was presented with a litany of questions of, you know, but the bad guy can shoot through that door, or the bad guy can, he's going to climb in through that window, or the bad guy's going to do this, the bad guy's going to do that. They have run all these thoughts through their mind, and all they needed to hear from me was, yeah, maybe the bad guy can do that, but all we need to buy is a little bit of time, because if I lock that door, that's going to slow the guy down a little bit. He's either going to go somewhere else, or at least it's going to slow him down. Because by the time we have taken that action, every cop within 20 miles is on the way to the school. We just have to hold out, you know, for the 5 minutes until, you know, the it's you know, the police are just descending upon the place. And when they realized that, nobody had told them that. So they were afraid of it. So I don't think it's safe to say that talking to the kids about these kinds of things will make them afraid. I'm going to give the final code number, and then I will just kind of wrap up and maybe allow a little bit of time for questions. Our last code number is S-588. S-588 is the last code number. I have a couple of links here at the end of the material for further reading. If you want to learn more about substitute teaching, if you think that might be a fun thing for you to do, and really a good, a really important service to your community if you're able to do that, I have some words of wisdom about that at my blog, which is the first link. I also talk a little bit more about that 1915 St. John's School fire, where the doors opened inward. Here's another link to the 1959 National Fire Protection Association report about the Chicago fire that killed 90 students. And the last link is some guidance from FEMA about how to develop an emergency plan for your school district, as is now required, at least in the state of Iowa. So at this point, we have reached the top of the hour here. We've even gone over a little bit. I am, at this point, just going to unmute us ever so briefly.
Shame.
And if there are any questions...
Are you still on?
No, I'm
okay. He's unmuted.
Did you have a question? Okay, I think that was just... Yeah, I think that was just some background noise I heard there, and I did not see any emails. There is one question. And how are the schools preparing for a shooter with an AR and multiple round magazines who jumps on a school bus filled with grade school students, shoots the driver, it's these kinds of things are going to take place not just in the school building, the school bus, another potential vulnerable situation. And that's why it's important to be able to think openly about this and come up with ideas, because that's not the first thing I would have thought of would be how to protect the kids on the school bus. So another potential area of concern. So anyway, at this point, I will stop the recording, and I'll just have about a few concluding remarks for our live listeners. Podcast listeners, again, email those code numbers to clem.law@usa.net for credit.